It's the 1st of July 2014. This is the next in a series of interviews with local members of the Hall District as part of the Hall Voices of Hall District project. Today I'm speaking with Mr. Tony Morris. We'll be discussing the history of the Morris family, who were a significant family, and their descendants, of course, and their associated relatives in the Hall Ginninderra district. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning, Phil.
My first piece of research recorded that Henry Morris was the first member of the Morris family to come to the district, and he settled in Ginninderra.
That's correct, Phil. He came as a convict on the Andromeda with a privileged passage because he was a cobbler boot maker and he looked after the sailors and military men's boots on the way out. He was allowed to travel to Cobbity near Campbelltown in Sydney, where he spent a small amount of time there. He married Hannah Cook and they moved directly to Ginninderra village and established a boot making business and a tannery kit to tan their own hides and leathers. They had 11 children, one of whom was William or Billy Morris, who learnt the trade with his father, from his father and mother, and moved to Hall when the village was declared a village, and he bought a block and built the bootmaker's shop in Hall, and he was known as 4B Billy, the bootmaker, barber, bicycle mender and banker. And his daughters also ran some dressmaking and a lolly shop in that shop as well for a period of time. One of his children, William and his wife, took on Louisa Gozzard, took in orphan children or children in difficulties, and they were also trained in bootmaking, and all of the family families right through were competent bootmakers and particularly surgical bootmakers. That line carried on through to William Henry Morris, who was known as Harry, and ran a boot. He moved to Canberra and in the early days of Canberra, and opened a bootmaker's shop opposite the Jollymont Centre, and eventually moved it round opposite in the centre of Melbourne buildings facing Northbourne Avenue, where he worked until he was retired. My father learnt the bootmaking trade, but he and William also went into the taxi hire car business, and my father eventually moved into that business, and that was the family business that I was raised in Canberra over a period of time. Things were pretty tough and tight during that time. I was born in 1942, around about the beginning of the Second World War. Clothing was rationed, food was rationed, petrol was rationed. So, and my father was kept at home because he was an essential service as a bootmaker and a taxi driver carrier. So, we had a great life as young kids. Very few toys. What we owned was very precious. I can remember having flour bag pockets and liners in our trousers, and the family was only entitled to a certain meterage or in those days, yardage of fabrics to make clothing, etc. But we had a great life, and my grandfather donated my first bike at 13 years of age, and then I was mobile, and I enjoyed life after that.
What was your father's name?
Rex.
Rex.
Rex, yes.
Right. I've asked each of the interviewees that I've spoken to, I know we're going back a fair way, but did you know of any stories of the original Morrises that came to Ginninderra, Henry and Hannah? Was there any stories that were passed down the line?
Henry and Hannah, not a lot was mentioned about Henry. I think one of the that sad things at one stage, he was arrested in Queanbeyan at a ripe old age for being of unsound mind, and it was explained where he went to court, and it was explained to the judge by his son William that he'd had some brandy to steady himself, and he was afraid the doctors were going to bleed him again because he'd been bled a few weeks before, and he felt quite unwell after that. And he had noticed a policeman outside and ran out and said, "Save me, save me." And the policeman thought he was out of his mind, but he was just very anxious. But that's about the only thing I can remember about Henry himself.
Mm. Back in those days, Ginninderra was a small, as they call it, unofficial village. It perhaps had the store. The school hadn't been built, I don't think, in that early stage. Post office would have come a bit later, I imagine. So it would have been quite a Spartan life there.
It was, yes. They built a small cottage and they ran the making business out of that.
Mm.
Yeah, and as the village grew, the Ginninderra School was built, and some of the Morrises, or some of the William Morrises that were in Hall, had to go to Ginninderra to school until the Hall School was built in 1912. Yeah.
We've heard some interesting stories about William. I mean, he was, as you mentioned, he was the four Bs, the bootmaker, bicycle repairer, banker and barber, but he was also quite a talented musician.
He was, and he played the violin. It was nothing unusual for him to knock off work in the afternoon, pedal his bike to Queanbeyan, play for a ball in the evening and pedal back home, ready for work next morning. He wrote the Canberra Waltz, or he played the Canberra Waltz for years, or a waltz tune that he made popular. And then eventually his daughter, who studied music as well, she transposed it for publication. William insisted that all the family learnt music, all the family learned violin, Kathleen, his daughter, had polio as a young child, and he had her taught piano to free up her hands, and that became her profession for many years. She taught music both at Hall and in Canberra as well.
Hmm.
And made a very good life, livelihood out of music.
The early 20th century must have been a busy time in Hall, because we did have the bootmaker shop, of course. We had George Kinley's side with his blacksmithing and carriage building. We had the saddler, had the little shop, the store over the road. So it would have been quite a nice little community back then.
It was a very nice community, I believe. And everybody looked out for everybody else. Because of... the way things were, each person didn't always have work. So William would get some people to help him occasionally in the shop, or he'd go off and help others. The saddler and people like that used to work around the village doing other things until they picked up work. So everybody helped each other and worked with the community to enjoy life. Yeah.
There's also the story that, was it his daughter, Zilla, used to bring up his lunch every day when at the shop?
Yes. William, all his life, had a hot meal at lunchtime, which was carried. He had built a house for he and his wife on the edge of the Yass Road, or the Barton Highway as it is now, which is about a mile and a half from the village. The daughter, Zilla, used to pedal each day with a hot meal wrapped in a tea towel, hanging on the handlebars down, and deliver the lunch. She claimed she only ever fell off once, and she still didn't spill the lunch.
What about William's, well, I suppose generally the women of the family, stories of, the wives, William's wife, Louisa, and their association with the community and the village?
Yes, well, Louisa was a skilled shoemaker as well. They all were, but she, whenever there was somebody a family in difficulty, she would help. She would take in the children and raise the children in her house. She did a lot of work around the village and helped down at the Ginninderra School and that sort of thing. So they were, the Morris family were certainly involved in the day-to-day living.
Did you meet your grandmother and grandfather? Were they still
around? They were my great-grandparents. No, I didn't.
Mm.
No, most of the stories I hear are related to me by their children.
Mm.
And they ended up having a couple of children. One daughter, Zilla, who married her partner when he was 60 years of age, and they had 30 years of marriage life, which is pretty good.
Amazing, yeah. There's also the story, just reflecting back on William's life as a bootmaker, of the large pair of boots that we are fortunate to have a photograph of in the museum.
That's right. There was a Welshman that lived around who was a massive man, and he had, about size 16 feet. William would make him a pair of boots occasionally, they were massive compared to the ordinary man's size. He had two halfpennies nailed to the counter in the boot shop to signify the length of the boot, and it was said that you could put a small child in one of the boots, a baby in one of the boots, they were so big.
Your grandfather, Harry.
Yes.
He took over the business, but you said he relocated to Canberra.
That's right. When the military college opened in Duntroon, Harry used to go to the military college and pick up the army boots and also sell produce, chickens and eggs, to the families at Duntroon. And eventually that became a pretty big job. So they decided they'd open a shop in Civic because that was closer and easier to access Duntroon and those areas.
Mm.
Duntroon and Acton, of course, the Acton cottages where the workers were working that were developing the ACT.
Yeah, that would have been an interesting time. Do you have memories of that time with your grandfather?
Later times in the boot shop, yes. Used to visit the boot shop when it was opposite the Jollymont Centre, which in that stage contained the police station. So it was always great to go to the boot shop and see what the police were up to. Then around and watch the buses come in Northbourne Avenue when the shop moved around there, yes.
Mm. Did your grandfather tell you any stories about, you know, incidents that happened with him?
No, he was always busy. The bootmakers, they work from dark in the morning till dark at night. He established a house in Farrer Street in Braddon, and he used to ride his bike down to the bootmaker's shop every morning and ride home late in the evening, and he just worked.
Mm.
And when he retired, he had a little boot repair workshop at the back of his garage, so that was his total life, was working in the shop, and my father took over the taxi business.
Your father wasn't focused on the bootmaking side of things, more interested in the...
He learnt the trade, but the taxi business grew, particularly after the war, and so he bought out that part of Henry's business and took that over, and that's what he ran as a family business, and that money helped us, raised us.
So you grew up in Canberra.
That's right.
That you used to spend school holidays and...
That's right. Every opportunity we had, we'd come out to Hall from a very young age. I think I was probably about four when I first visited the family farm at Wattle Park, which was on my mother's side, which was the Thomas Southville line down through Sampson Southville and then Sampson James Southville, and they were all farmers and carriers in the area as well. So that line came down through to into my family line, and yes, we visited the farm regularly, my brothers and sisters and cousins, And over the period of years, we also had friends from the local families in Hall come and stay with us over the holiday period. And it was a great time. It was a rambling big old house with plenty of bedrooms and verandas that you could sleep on when it was hot in the summer. And my aunt was a great cook, and she kept us sustained on Anzac biscuits and porridge and the eggs and all the good things.
What farm was that? What was that one called?
That was Wattle Park.
Oh, Wattle Park, yeah, right. Yeah. Up behind the Wattle Park Church.
Yes, on Spring Range Road.
Spring Range Road.
And that was originally taken up by Samson Southwell, and his brother took up land next door, and they built the two homesteads so as they had a window visible from either homestead, which they would leave a light in overnight, and they knew if they got up at night and looked and the light was out that they needed to go and check on the other household to make sure everything was right, because that was their signalling message that something was wrong.
Oh, it's a great community connection, isn't it?
Yes, yeah.
During that time, you were growing up, did you spend a bit of time coming into the village for entertainment and meeting friends?
Yeah, that was we generally played around on the farm all week, but Saturday was the special day. And my uncle Alan was a bachelor. He worked on the farm, and on Saturdays he had he'd save all his pennies, and on Saturday he'd divide the pennies up amongst the cousins and whoever was there, and we'd jump in the old family Dodge, which was a six-cylinder Dodge, and with a fabric hood, and we'd load the egg boxes onto the carrier at the back, and we'd bring the eggs into town because they raised some money by selling eggs to the local storekeeper store, which was run by the Browns, and we'd bring the eggs in. Our aunt Jean Southwell worked in the shop, so we'd pound through the shop and eye off all the lollies and sort out what we're going to buy later, and then we'd unload the eggs, trundle across, leave the grocery list, trundle across to Jimmy Rochford's Ampol garage. It was at that time. Oh no, it was I think it was Plume, Vacuum and Plume at that stage, and he had a hand bowser. We'd fill up the old Dodge. He'd let us pull the lever to let the petrol run down out of the globe at the top of the bowser once it'd be pumped up there by hand. And I can remember Jim's shop as the old shed with still some of the Kinley side yards around it. So that was very early in the piece. Then we'd trundle around, and everybody played tennis on the hall tennis courts, and that was a great social afternoon. If you didn't play tennis, you sat and yarned, and then when it was time, you'd slip back to the shop, pick up the groceries, we'd drive home, have tea, and then every fortnight we'd come back to the movies at night, and that was fascinating, at the movies at night. It was a great experience for all of us.
I've heard some interesting stories about the movies. Colin Southwell was, I believe, the main projectionist there, and get movies in, and then would have a 44-gallon drum of coals to heat up the room. Is that right?
That's correct. And all the youngsters would have blankets, and they'd there was quite a bit of open space around the drum of coke, and so we'd all get on blankets down on the floor there and watch the movies from there. Often we didn't see the end of the movies, but it was great fun, and the locals would sit around with bare knees if they were close to the coke drums, and rugs over their knees if they were up the back.
And what happened during a break in the film?
We'd the lights had come on, and Mr. Brown would go over and open his store, and those who wanted ice creams or chocolates or lollies would go over there. Those who wanted a tipple would go to their cars and have a little drink. And many years later, my Aunt Jean, who lived in Winalia for a long time, had a hedge, and I decided I'd clean out behind the hedge, and I found bottles of many ages that have been left there.
I understand that at the Kinley side or Rochford Hall there was a lot of dances and balls and fundraising activities.
There was, and they were fabulous. We'd come in as youngsters, the whole group of us, and there'd be massive suppers, there'd be dance music. I can remember Oz Southall and Case Crudoff on the Case Crudoff on the drums, and they'd play dance music for hours, and we'd dance and dance. Then the suppers had come out with great big aluminium pots of tea and coffee, and the girls had come round with sugar and milk, and we had a wonderful time at those dances and really enjoyed them.
Were they a church-organised
event? No, they were mainly fundraisers or just general community dances. Mm. The church itself, because it was a Methodist church, didn't believe in dancing, so it was for a long time the Methodists didn't participate, but eventually a lot of the young ones broke away and they would enjoy the dancing and enjoy the fun, so that was interesting.
That would be the Wattle Park Church you're talking about, the
yes,
Methodist
yes,
Church.
Yes.
Yeah. Characters in the village around that time, were there any sort of real characters? I know of the people that operated the businesses, and they used to have what they called the poem is called the Parliament at Hall, where you had the George Kinley sides and the your grandfather or great grandfather William Morris all getting together on a afternoon to discuss
events. They'd get in together and discuss the goings on and happenings around the village and take action if it was necessary, but they generally enjoyed life and exchanged points of view and debated various things that were happening around in the world or wherever, because communication was fairly poor in those days, and you often didn't get newspapers for weeks after they'd been printed. So.
The main street of Hall, Victoria Street, of course, is the main road between Queanbeyan and Yass, or Canberra and Yass.
That's
in your early days, what was that like? Was it busy with vehicular traffic, or was it still transitioning?
In the early days, it was very slow. There was a few vehicles through, but there wasn't a lot of vehicles when I was a youngster. And I can remember it had a very rough sort of bitumen on it, and one of the things that would happen in the summertime, you'd have sandals on, you'd run across the road and catch your big toe and take the top off it because the gravel was so coarse in the road. But and it took a long time before the main street was actually properly sealed and developed.
And what are your memories of walking up the main street? You've mentioned the shop and Jim Rochford's garage. What else was in the village back in those days?
It was pretty sparse. From the bottom end, I can just remember the old slab boarding house at the corner of the Victoria Street as you came in. It was always whitewashed and clean, and it was later demolished and a small shop built there. But there was Kinley Side Hall, the blacksmith shop. Then there was what had been the dressmakers and saddlers shop that ended up as, in my later years, ended up as a place called Indonesia, where they sold Indonesian artefacts and trinkets out of. And then was the old bootmaker's shop, then a small little office for the stock and station agent, and it was just an office. There was Colton's house. He was a stock and station agent who had moved from the top end of Victoria Street. The Church of England Church, I can remember being partially built because the war slowed it down, but then it was completed later on, and there was the school. there was Kui, and then up further was the Southwells house on the corner, which is now the Vets, and the Murphy's house, and Kui. On the other side was Avoca, and Alfield's cottage, which was a combination of slabs and packing cases. And then there was the house that the Coltons had had on the top of the hill, and then the Bolton house at the top of the hill, and then onto the Catholic Church.
Mm.
So most of the other houses came later. A lot of the other houses came later.
Yeah.
So it was a pretty vacant main street.
On the other side, you would have had Winalia, the shop, and Banksia.
That's right, Winalia, the shop, Banksia. And then Butler's house on the corner where the aged people's units are now.
Mm.
And nothing in between. So they were all vacant blocks, and that enabled the brown boys to race around and drive their old vehicles and whatever as they matured and grew up.
Oh, I see. Growing up, you went to school in Canberra or Civic?
I went to Ainslie Infant School and Ainslie Primary School, which was only a short walk. We lived in Limestone Avenue, and it was only a 5-minute walk to school. Then when I reached secondary school age, it was fairly selective, and although people won't admit it, it seemed to be that public servants' children went to Canberra High and the rest went to Tilopia Park, which my first year at Tilopia was the first year it had been declared a full high school. It was only an intermediate high school before that. But that was probably interesting because my mother and aunts all went to Tilopia Park to intermediate level, which was the highest level you could attain at that stage. But I went to Tilopia, which was a half-hour bus trip to and from each day, and sometimes I'd ride my bike as I was older, and we'd ride down across what is now the lake bed, across Coppens Crossing, and up through Tilopia Park to the school. But they were interesting years because the migrants had started to come, so we had to deal with people that couldn't speak English and all that sort of thing. So we became quite a cosmopolitan school, as most schools did in those days, yeah.
Hmm. When you finished school, did you have any idea what you wanted to do with your life?
I'd started wanting to be a motor mechanic, but the first jobs I got were sweeping the floor and getting the morning teas, and the guys always tried to diddle me, and I thought, no, this is not for me. I'll be smarter than that. So I decided at the end of high school that I wanted to be a draftsman. Jobs were easy to get. I went to the public service board and they said, well, put you in treasury, which I probably should have stayed, but I didn't like working in an office so much and dealing with finance. So I got a transfer eventually after about 9 or 10 months into the drawing office, which was at Old Acton, where most of the hospital was eventually built. But we had weatherboard offices over there, and they were, was where the motor registry and all the government offices were when I started working here, yes.
Mm-hmm. So Canberra was pretty small, or just growing then too, wasn't it?
It was, and you would go to, say, Civic on a Saturday morning, and you knew everybody there. You knew all the people, because that's how small Canberra was. And the Sydney buildings, one side of the road was the shops, the other side of the road was the big hedge, and you went down an embankment towards the old railway line, which had been decommissioned by then, but there was no shops across the road, and the only buildings further along that street, which was Maud Street, was the YWCA building, and a building that became 2CA, the radio station, and then the Civic Theatre beside that.
And of course, there was no lake in those days.
No,
mm.
no, and I watched the the development of the lake. Before that, we used to go sneak down and play along the river, which was taboo in my family, but I managed to get away occasionally. Then we watched the development of the lake as it came up, and the building of the bridges on dry land before the lake filled. And but we used to get to look at the building of the lake wall and that sort of thing. And then we knew basically what it looked like, because we'd had some massive floods through that sort of filled out the area, like pretty much like the lake is now.
Your father, just going back to your father with his taxi business, and Canberra, of course, being the centre of the federal government, was he employed to drive politicians around, or parliamentarians?
Yes, certainly. His task was, he used to get up and meet the 5 o'clock train in the morning, and there was an evening train also, and that went on for quite a while. And then after the war, aircraft were used much more, and a lot of the politicians used to fly in by then. But previous to that, he'd be picking up the politicians and taking them to Parliament and that sort of thing. The pressure on people in those days was pretty massive. He would start four in the morning to get to the railway station by five, and he often didn't go to bed till after midnight if there was something on. It's only a few hours sleep. And also, I can still remember petrol rationing, and we had a collection of handmade funnels hanging in the shed, all made appropriate to the vehicle that was running as a taxi at that stage, so as you could pour petrol out of drums into the taxi, because you couldn't always get it out of the ground from bowsers or anything. So.
You mentioned the war. What impact did the war have? I'm particularly interested in Hall. I know you were a youngster then, but were you aware of it affecting people in Hall at that time?
No, not really, because a lot of the things that were rationed, say, in Canberra, were available from the farm. I mean, we had butter and flour and sugar and those things. I mean, sugar was rationed, but they got a fair supply and that sort of thing. The effect was that there was a lot of single people around. It left a lot of single ladies around, and a lot of men. I can remember men with limbs missing and things like that, that you don't see nowadays. That was very much more common, and I think a lot more people with strange attitudes too, because they'd been through tough times, and a lot of them were either recluses or didn't want to be part of the community that much. It had had a massive effect on people.
Yeah,
over a period of time.
Just getting back to Hall, you've covered, your working life. You live in Hall now. You obviously have a passion or an attraction for it. When did you take the opportunity to move to Hall?
1965, Margaret and I were married, and we were looking for accommodation, and we were all the families went to Wattle Park for Christmas, and they happened to mention over Christmas dinner that Ross Brown had a flat vacant, and so we called in on Christmas afternoon, and he said we were looking for accommodation. Which were two rooms at the back of Winalia, and he said, "Oh yeah, you can have it." So we lived there for 9 or 10 months, and then our house came up for sale, and we bought that. And that it's been an interesting place. I spent a whole day pulling nails out of the wall when I first got there, out of the kitchen wall, that were put in to hang things on, and I thought I got them all. And that night we were going out, and I walked past and tore my shirt on the nail I'd missed. So we've been in that house and Hall ever since, and it's been a wonderful place to live. Our children, Heather and Craig, loved it because they had the freedom of the village. They could race billy carts down through the timber at the back of the house, or they could go down to the creek and play, or they could do whatever they like, and they were free. And they had there was a lot of young children around at that time that they all joined up in bands and played together and had a great time.
In the 60s, I suppose that was a time when Hall was a small village outside the big metropolis of Canberra, and still maintained, you know, the typical village community
ideals. That certainly did, and we quickly got involved in the community, because it was small, and the headmaster called a public meeting, and when we got to it, there was only Margaret and I, and a person who was an officer who was promoting rural youth or junior farmers at that stage. So we got involved in a junior farmer rural youth group early in the piece. And also there were two very prominent ladies in the village. There was Betty Rasker and Nikki Duggan, who loved dancing, and they wanted to get a permanent place for dancing, because Kindleyside Hall was being used for other things and particularly the pictures at that stage. So we got involved with them because I was a young person, working to gain the pavilion for community use, and that involved inviting some important public servants out to dances. The pavilion at that stage was unlined with wire netting as windows, and they chose midwinter to do this, so very quickly got some action. And in those days, it was easy to get the government maintenance workshops to come out, and they did the first maintenance on the pavilion and lined it and put cupboards and things and put a small kitchen in it. And then later on, we worked towards getting toilets and verandas as an extension on it. And they were designed by, at that stage, a local architect who lived in the village. And so it was all village orientated. And I can remember at a function at the opening of the pavilion, once it had been renovated, that our local fellow called Curtis Moore, who was regarded as a prominent person because he was a prominent grazier in the village, and he spoke at the opening, and he talked about them over the hill, and that was Canberra. We were separate.
You mentioned rural youth. I know your association, together with Margaret's association with rural youth, was for a very long time. How many years were you involved?
38 years we ran it, and we were involved with local, district, and state, and it was a very worthwhile organisation. It originated from a joining of education, a Department of Education, a Department of Agriculture, wanting to educate soldier settlers after the war, and because they were having hard times and weren't very good agriculturalists. So the organisation was set up to teach the children about growing vegetables and fruit and raising animals. And that sort of worked. Those children became very skilled farmers, and they also, because of the style of organisation, it also taught them how to become community leaders and active in their community. So it was a great organisation. Mm,
very worthwhile by the sound of it.
Yes, it was sad it folded in the end, but both education and agriculture realised that it had worked so well that the schools had taken on a lot of those projects, and other organisations had taken on the projects, so they withdrew their support, and it became almost impossible to run without good support.
Mm. You came to the village in 1965. Oh, well, you bought your...
Yes, yeah.
When did you start your association with the Progress Association?
Well, at that time, yeah. First, decided I'd better be part of the village and joined up and have been part of the Progress Association ever since, and been vice president many times, and now I'm actually at the moment a vice president and trying to mentor others about some of the sort of unwritten rules of the village, or the way the village runs, and how the community works. And
that would have changed somewhat over the years you've been here, though.
Oh, it has. I mean, some of the things you notice is when we were here, and for many years, everybody just had a netting fence that was only a metre high. And you could wander around and you knew who was where and what was where. You weren't sticky beaks, but you kept an eye out. And if you noticed somebody hadn't been out of the house for a few days or something was going on, you just went and checked to make sure that their welfare was okay. And they did the same with you. And but that's all changed now. You walk around the village and there's 2-metre-high fences blocking off all the houses, and people, although they're still, the community spirit is still great, it's not quite the same as it used to be. It's lost a lot of that really closeness.
Mm. One of the main features of the village was the Hall Show. What was your association, and Margaret's association, with the Hall Show?
Well, not really much, because it moved out in the 60s. Mm-hmm. But we, my aunt, who'd been a cake steward at the Canberra, the Hall Show became the Canberra Show, and she'd been a cake steward for 40 years, and she said, well, it's time I trained somebody, so she invited Margaret. Margaret took on the task, and when we started Rural Youth, we also ran what we called a show camp, which was to bring other children from around the district in, and they would camp or stay in the pavilion here at Hall, and they'd go in each day to the Canberra show, and I became a steward then, and looked after the Rural Youth stall, and we've been stewards ever since, and now we're the preserves and pickles and jam stewards at the Canberra show, and then done that for ourselves for over 40 years, and for the last 8 years we've also been, we were invited to be stewards for the craft at the Queanbeyan show. So, well, we believe that the competition is healthy and good for people to improve their talents, and we enjoy presenting the judging in a way that people can ask the judges questions and that sort of thing. And so it's a really good educational process for the community.
Mm. Your two children went to the Hall School.
They did, yes.
And it's I know it's a lovely little school, and it was very unfortunate, if that's the right word, that it closed in 2006. What was your feelings about the school closure back then?
Well, we were greatly disappointed, and we joined the protest groups and did our best to force the government to have it remain open, but that wasn't to be. So we then pitched our efforts into trying to get something active going on the school site, so that we might be able to at least preserve the site, and we've worked towards that with many others in the village since.
Yeah, it's amazing how the Hall School was such an important connection with the village, from what I've read and spoken to other members of the Hall community. The linkage, you know, of your ancestors who went to the Hall School, and your family that went to the Hall School.
Well, the school was basically the heart of the village. It was, it's where everybody's children went, and they met each other's children. They went to, they learnt together. All the community worked for the school. It broke down the religious barriers. yeah, everybody worked from all the religions worked together in the school, and so it was basically a hub of contact and communication and also enjoyment, recreation.
Mm.
People worked for the school fete, everybody came to the school fete, people came to the school concerts, all that sort of thing. You know, schools are really, if a country town loses its school, then it falls to pieces, basically.
Mm. And what's your favourite memory of Hall? Do you have a particular favourite? Or?
I don't, actually. I just enjoy the village completely, and the people and those that come and visit. You know, it's just, everything's a favourite memory for me.
Mm. And where do you see the village being in 20 years' time?
Well, it will evolve. I've always said the village is an evolution of architecture and society and people, and there'll be some older buildings preserved. There'll be people who want to build newer buildings and that sort of thing, and things will change. They always change, and they have to change, but hopefully we'll be able to preserve enough of the old to keep the village being an viably economical in its own way.
Mm.
And that we can keep our shop and our post office and our service station and all those services which have been here since the start of the village.
In the last 20 years have been quite an important time for Hall. I've been associated, as you know, in the last 20 years, and we've had, you know, the closure of the school, we've had the possibility of rural residential development on our border. There's been the discussions with the ACT government about establishing a master plan. The village is now heritage listed. So a lot of protection has gone in to protect that environment that you're talking about.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Mm.
So hopefully that will continue. And I know that with the passion of people like yourself, that the fight will still continue.
It will. Yeah. It certainly will.
All right. Thank you, Tony. On that note, I think we'll conclude, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Phil. It's been a wonderful morning.